stay on their parents' insurance either. Children up to age 26 may also be denied coverage under their parents' plan if they are able to obtain health insurance through their employer. No annual or lifetime caps on benefits. Insurance companies have traditionally held down their costs by capping the amount of money they pay out on claims, limiting the duration of payments to a given year or to some other period of time in a beneficiary's lifetime. Obamacare eliminates these limits. The ban on lifetime limits ended in September 2010 for all health insurance plans, even those already in operation. Plans with grandfathered status are not exempt. As for annual limits, a full ban begins in January 2014. Before that time, the ceiling on annual limits is steadily raised for all employer-based plans and new individual plans as follows. September 2010, $750,000. September 2011, $1,250,000. September 2012, $2 million. January 2014, no limit allowed. Although the elimination of time-sensitive caps on insurance benefits is a popular measure, it restricts the choices of American consumers. No longer will they be able to buy bargain basement insurance plans, which are offered at low prices in part because they include strict limits on the amount of money that can be paid out in benefits. Although these mini-med plans are frequently attacked by critics as equivalent to inferior snake oil insurance, millions of low-income Americans and the businesses they work for have come to rely on the coverage they provide, notwithstanding their deficiencies compared to pricier coverage. Supporters of Obamacare generally want to eliminate this market, and many, including Senator John D. Rockefeller of West Virginia, were angered when the White House granted non-compliance waivers to companies like McDonald's, allowing them to continue mini-med coverage for their employees. Believing that more than a million Americans are duped by these low-cost plans, Rockefeller asserted that they are worse than nothing because of the false expectations and the false hope they set up for consumers, who often find the coverage they need is not actually included in their plan. No rescissions. One of the biggest complaints against insurance companies has been their controversial use of so-called rescissions, an unsavory practice used to deny coverage immediately after a person suffers a serious and costly health setback. Rather than cover legitimate medical costs as promised by contractual agreement, the insurance company cancels the policyholder's entire insurance plan. Often, insurers justify the action by citing a policyholder's misstatements in their insurance contract, even if these are minor, unintentional errors that have nothing to do with the health setback the policyholder needs covered. As of September 2010, insurers are no longer permitted to cancel the insurance plans of policyholders for these types of frivolous reasons. Although this is obviously the right thing to do and one of the better parts of Obamacare, it will no doubt serve to exert upward pressure on the premiums everyone has to pay, as insurers are forced to pay out more in benefits than in the past. Keep in mind that this provision of Obamacare does not mean that an insurance company can never cancel an individual's policy. If outright fraud has been committed, the new rule will not help protect the wrongdoer, who will likely lose his or her coverage as a consequence. Essential health benefits covered. Beginning in January 2014, all new insurance plans, whether they are offered through the private, group, or exchange markets, will be required to include coverage for essential health benefits. This rule effectively creates a new national standard for health insurance, raising the quality of coverage for all Americans. The list of essential health services has not yet been decided by the Department of Health and Human Services, but it did release information about the broad areas covered by the list. We also know that each plan must, at the very least, cover 60% of the medical costs, on average, of its enrollees. That is, the minimum level of coverage represented by the bronze plan sold through the exchanges. While this new rule seems reasonable enough on the surface, it will, in conjunction with other Obamacare rules, prevent insurance companies from offering bargain basement mini-med plans to consumers. Plans that have historically been profitable for them and attractive to many American consumers and businesses. Mandating essential health benefits is a little bit like the government outlawing motorcycles because they offer less protection in an accident than an automobile. Such a requirement would undoubtedly reduce injuries and deaths on the road, but it would also encroach on the choices that Americans have always been free to make for themselves. Many Obamacare rules make a similar trade-off in favor of more protection, generating opposition from those who wish to retain the range of choices that have been available to them in the past. Medical loss ratios tightened. In an effort to suppress insurance plans that allocate a large portion of premiums toward non-medical expenses, such as administration, marketing, overhead, and profits, Obamacare establishes tighter limits on medical loss ratios, or MLR. This metric, expressed as a percentage of an insurance plan's total revenue, is used by the insurance industry to describe how much is paid out directly to policyholders in benefits. The decision to establish a firm MLR is one of the better aspects of Obamacare. Back in 1993, a time when many more nonprofit insurers existed, the average MLR stood at 95%, meaning that the typical insurer paid out 95 cents of every dollar the company took in from premiums for the claims of policyholders. In the 20 years since that time, that level dropped to about 80% as nonprofit insurers disappeared and Wall Street demanded more and more profit-taking. Not wanting the level to fall even more, Obamacare creates a new floor. In the large group market, where big businesses shop, insurance plans must now spend 85% or more of their revenue on the direct medical costs of plan participants, and if they do not, they must reimburse participants with rebates that make up the difference to them. In the individual and small group markets, where small businesses buy their health insurance, the threshold is set a little lower, at 80%, in deference to the reality that smaller plans have less budget flexibility than bigger plans. The new Obamacare MLR thresholds are already in place, and many Americans may have noticed unexpectedly receiving rebate checks in the mail from their health insurance provider. In total, almost 13 million people have received about $1.1 billion from insurers who generated MLRs that fell below the new thresholds. Failure to comply with the new rule could trigger even more painful consequences for insurers than merely having to send out rebate checks to their policyholders. If an insurance plan does not meet the Obamacare threshold for 3 straight years, it could be prevented from selling policies to new customers. If it fails to meet it for 5 straight years, the Department of Health and Human Services could terminate the insurance plan's contract with all of its existing policyholders. Needless to say, the new rule governing medical loss ratios is one of the most unpleasant parts of Obamacare for the insurance industry to swallow. It is a new rule that has not received the attention it deserves. What exactly constitutes a direct medical expense? That is still something of an open question. Insurers, of course, want the broadest interpretation possible to give them more flexibility to manage their balance sheets. Consumer groups, in contrast, want a narrow interpretation so that more money is paid out in insurance benefits to policyholders. To balance these competing interests, the new law directed the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, NAIC, to establish the criteria that would be used to determine what was and what was not a direct medical expense. The Commission issued its report in October 2010, which the Department of Health and Human Services is expected to certify and eventually make operative. Here are a few of NAIC's more important rulings. Aggregating costs across state lines. Insurers wanted to be able to calculate their medical loss ratios using regions of the country as large as possible so that they could even out their expenses as needed. The NAIC recommended that they could not do this, requiring them to calculate their ratios only within a given state. Federal taxes excluded. Although the new law directly states that federal and state taxes and licensing or regulatory fees should be excluded when medical loss ratios are calculated, congressional Democrats insisted that this referred only to taxes imposed specifically by Obamacare. In a victory for the insurance industry, the NAIC ruled that the language of the law should be interpreted to mean all federal taxes, including income taxes, but not taxes on investment gains. If this NAIC ruling remains in force, insurers will have an easier time reaching the medical loss ratios required by law. As such, it's a victory for them. Year-to-year fluctuations. Small insurance companies in particular were worried that they would have difficulty reaching a consistent 80% medical loss ratio every year because of natural fluctuations in their business over extended periods of time. Some years they might pay out a large amount in benefits, and in others the amount could be relatively small as revenues grow to be used against future outlays. Receptive to this argument, the NAIC recommended that credits called credibility adjustments be given to small insurers to help them even out temporary imbalances. Fraud control and utilization review. Insurers wanted their attempts to limit fraud and their internal reviews, in which they decided whether or not to cover specific medical treatments, to be excluded from their medical loss ratio calculation. The NAIC ruled against them. When issuing these rulings, the NAIC stated that the formula for calculating medical loss ratios was not something that should be considered set in stone. It said that the formula should evolve over time to reflect the realities of the marketplace. If, for instance, the formula proved an unreasonable hardship for insurance companies, it might have to be loosened. Critics of Obamacare argue that the medical loss ratios established by the new law will effectively push small insurance companies, which typically have low medical loss ratios because they must pay more for administrative costs and the like than large insurance companies, out of the market. If that happened, it would decrease the level of overall competition and put upward pressure on insurance prices. But it's more likely that the ratio would be adjusted down for small insurers if such an action were needed to protect their position in the market. Restrictions on premium discrimination. Under Obamacare, insurers will no longer be able to reject people because of a pre-existing health condition, nor will they be able to charge people higher premiums if they have one. The new law prevents most other types of price discrimination by stipulating that premiums within a health insurance plan can only be different person to person based on an individual's age. Premiums for older people cannot be more than 3 times as much than for younger people. Tobacco usage. Smokers can be charged higher premiums. Geographic location. Policyholders that live in a part of the state or region with a high cost of living can be charged more. While the effect of these non-discrimination rules will protect some policyholders from higher prices, it is likely to shift insurance costs to the entire pool of plan participants and increase premiums for everyone enrolled. In effect, it forces low-risk individuals to subsidize the health insurance of high-risk individuals. An obese couch potato, for example, will pay no more than one who is svelte and exercises regularly, everything else being equal between them. Right to appeal. Although its impact on insurance costs will likely be negligible, one other Obamacare rule is worth mentioning. If you get into a dispute with your insurance company, you'll be able to seek an outside review by a government agency. Some states already allow such reviews, but now you'll be able to do this throughout the entire country. The infrastructure is not yet in place to deal with appeals everywhere, but by 2014, it should be. Anyone still may choose to challenge his or her insurance company's decisions through the legal system. Will Obamacare rules apply to my current health insurance plan? President Obama repeatedly promised, both during his campaign for office and once he entered the White House, that Americans would be able to keep their health insurance. To help follow through on that promise, the new law stipulates that plans that were in operation prior to March 23, 2010, the day Obamacare became law, could be grandfathered, that is to say, exempted from most of the new rules and regulations. While this sounds great, the finer points in the provision drain it of real power. If you're enrolled in your employer's insurance plan, for instance, it's up to the company to determine whether or not it wants grandfathered status. According to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, only 35% of employers are expected to make this choice. That's because under the new law, employers can only keep their grandfathered status if they agree not to change their plans in other ways. For example, if a plan raises its premiums, drops some benefit, or changes its insurance carrier, it will immediately lose its grandfathered status. Whatever employers choose, they must notify their employees whether or not their insurance plan will be grandfathered or not. Intent on maintaining the flexibility to manage their plans, most employers will probably choose to comply with the new Obamacare rules. Because of this likelihood, it's fair to say that President Obama's promise that you can keep your current insurance will prove hollow in the end, an unintended consequence of the new law. Chapter 10. Turning the Screws on Medicare. Medicare is one of the most important components of the nation's healthcare system, providing coverage for the oldest Americans. All citizens age 65 and over can join the program, who also happen to be the group that needs the most care. Toward that end, the federal government spent $528 billion to support the program in 2010, a level expected to rise above $1 trillion by 2020. Given the ocean of money funding Medicare, it was inevitable that the authors of Obamacare would tap into it to pay for the new healthcare system. As a consequence, senior citizens suffer the biggest financial blow from the new law. That's because Medicare's budget is cut by about $45 billion per year on average over the next decade. In an effort to mask the bad taste of this medicine, Obamacare throws Medicare recipients a bone by improving their prescription drug coverage. But this gesture does not begin to make up for hundreds of billions in lost revenue. Still, it's something positive that seniors can welcome. Let's take a closer look at this sliver of good news before we move on to the budget cuts that cloud Medicare's future. Closing the donut hole. Very few younger Americans have probably ever heard of the donut hole in Medicare's prescription drug program. But if you're on Medicare and need expensive drugs, it's likely you have. Medicare recipients typically pay a deductible of a few hundred dollars and then 25% of the cost of the drugs they need up to a certain point, typically around $2,800 in a person's drug spending. That's when the infamous donut hole opens up, and recipients have to pay 100% of the cost of their drugs up until they reach $6,400 in drug spending. Beyond that amount, insurance coverage kicks in again to close the hole, with the recipient paying only 5% of drug costs above $6,400. Why does this coverage gap exist? As you might expect, the answer has to do with politics. When the legislation creating the Medicare Prescription Drug Program was passed in 2003, limiting coverage in this way was part of a cost-saving compromise that became necessary for the law to gain congressional approval. Although most people on Medicare never fall into the donut hole because their drug expenses don't rise high enough, Obamacare includes a plan to close it gradually over the next decade and help those who do. To accomplish that goal, President Obama and Democratic leaders in Congress made a deal with the pharmaceutical industry, which agreed to subsidize part of the cost of the expanded drug coverage. Here's how it works. In 2010, Medicare recipients who reached the donut hole received a $250 rebate to help reduce their costs. Starting in 2011, help from Big Pharma arrives, with the industry paying 50% of the cost of all brand-name drugs. Recipients pay the remaining 50%. By 2013, the federal government will step in and provide an additional subsidy. This will be phased in over time, and by 2020 will cover 25% of the cost of brand-name drugs, with Medicare recipients on the hook by that time for only 25% when the Big Pharma discount of 50% is factored in. The story is similar for generic drugs, except that there is no Big Pharma discount. Generic drugs, by definition, are not owned or manufactured by a single company. Because of this, the federal government will do more of the heavy lifting than it does for brand-name drugs, but the result will be the same for Medicare recipients. By 2020, they will only have to pay 25% of the cost of generic drugs they buy in the donut hole range, the same they will pay for brand-name drugs. More retirees may need to use Medicare's prescription drugs. One unforeseen consequence of Obamacare emerged soon after the passage of the law, when a group of companies began to drop prescription drug coverage for their retirees. They took this action because the new law, in a misguided effort to raise revenue to fund Obamacare, eliminated a key tax break that incentivized companies to give their retirees this benefit. Rather than pay more to the federal government, the affected companies simply decided to drop their drug coverage for retirees, forcing them onto Medicare's prescription drug plan. If this trend continues, a few million retirees across the country could wind up in the same position. Means testing, lower subsidies for high-income recipients. The other news in Medicare's prescription drug plan involves the expansion of means testing. Such testing already exists for high-income recipients as part of other parts of Medicare, and now it will function in a similar way with the prescription drug plan. Specifically, individuals with an income of $85,000 or higher and couples with an income of $170,000 or higher will receive a reduced subsidy that will increase the price they pay for their prescriptions. Medicare spending cuts. The closure of the donut hole is a nice benefit for Medicare recipients, but it shouldn't obscure the more important fact that a huge amount of the revenue needed to fund Obamacare will come directly out of Medicare's budget. According to the Congressional Budget Office, the nonpartisan government agency that makes budgetary forecasts, roughly 42% of the total $1 trillion cost of Obamacare will come from cuts in Medicare spending over the next decade. Although President Obama and congressional Democrats have downplayed the impact of these cuts, stating that they will not affect the quality of care Medicare provides, no one really knows for sure what will happen once spending decreases. One thing seems likely. With the federal government cutting almost $500 billion from a program that millions of senior citizens rely on, at least some recipients are going to feel it. The biggest cuts in Medicare will come in two main areas: a reduction in payment rates to providers, and a reduction in payment rates to Medicare Advantage plans. Let's look at each in turn. Medicare payment rate cuts. About one-fifth of the funding for Obamacare, or $196 billion, will come from cuts to Medicare's payment rates to providers other than physicians over the next 10 years. Money generated by this payment reduction will be redirected toward new healthcare priorities, such as the expansion of Medicaid and subsidies for the health insurance exchanges. The people who will feel the pinch the most will be those who currently receive this money, namely providers such as hospitals, skilled nursing facilities, and home health agencies who provide the care that Medicare recipients have come to expect. Critics of Obamacare have pointed out that providers could revolt against cuts in their pay and choose not to accept Medicare patients. If that happens, Medicare could become weakened by a phenomenon that has plagued the Medicaid program for years: the refusal of doctors and facilities to participate. As it stands today, private insurance already pays more than Medicare on a per-patient basis, and more doctors and providers may be pushed by the reductions to turn to that higher-paying source. What does this mean for you? If you're on Medicare, you may have to find a new doctor or wait longer for appointments with your current doctor because he or she has more Medicare patients to care for. It also could mean that the quality of doctors who serve Medicare patients decreases on average, lowering the quality of care you are accustomed to receiving. Certain facilities may also be less receptive to caring for Medicare beneficiaries. Medicare Advantage cuts. All Medicare recipients are likely to feel the effects of a reduction in payment rates to providers. But those who are enrolled in the Medicare Advantage program, about one in four, will feel additional pain. According to the Congressional Budget Office, these senior citizens will get about $68 less a month in Medicare Advantage benefits because of Obamacare. The Medicare Advantage program was designed to open up Medicare to private insurers like Cigna Health Insurance, Aetna Incorporated, and United Healthcare, with the goal of controlling costs as managed care plans had for many U.S. employers. It was thought that outside insurers would make better use of tax dollars than government bureaucrats, while simultaneously providing senior citizens with additional benefits beyond their standard Medicare coverage. Senior citizens usually need more than basic Medicare, which only covers about 60% of their medical expenses on average. Those with the financial means buy so-called Medigap coverage as a supplement. But those with lower incomes do not have this option. That's where Medicare Advantage comes in, giving government financial assistance to help lower-income senior citizens secure additional coverage. This additional coverage can include beneficiaries enjoying reduced copayments or coinsurance for services that the traditional Medicare program covers, but it can also include coverage for services such as hearing aids or gym memberships that Medicare does not normally cover. In cutting Medicare Advantage's spending, Obamacare, ironically enough, turns its guns on millions of low-income Americans, the people it supposedly committed to helping. How did that happen? Congressional Democrats seizing on a report that found that private insurance companies were not spending enough of their government-provided Medicare Advantage money on direct medical expenses, singled it out as a target for cuts. The program, in short, had an unacceptably low medical loss ratio, which suggested that private insurers were making excessive profits at the expense of taxpayers. To eliminate this inefficient use of taxpayer money, Obamacare cuts $136 billion out of the Medicare Advantage budget over the next 10 years. Some insurers in the program will be hurt more than others, depending on how well they use taxpayer dollars. That is, those with strong medical loss ratios will be protected from penalties and in some cases even rewarded. The impact on insurers will also vary by geographic location, depending on different performance standards established by counties within each state. How does this affect participants in the program? The private insurance companies that are part of Medicare Advantage will likely cut benefits and/or raise premiums. The insurers could also find the changes too much to bear and leave Medicare Advantage altogether, something that had been observed previously when payment rates to Medicare managed care plans were reduced. That has already begun to happen. In late 2010, Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare dropped Medicare Advantage, forcing 22,000 senior citizens in New England to look elsewhere to supplement their basic Medicare benefits. It did so because of reduced reimbursements and new rules that required it to create a network of doctors who would, on the whole, charge lower fees. As Lynn Bowman, a vice president of Harvard Pilgrim, said when explaining the company's decision, "We became concerned by the long-term viability of Medicare Advantage programs in general. We know that cuts in Medicare are being used to fund national health care reform. And we also had concerns about our ability to build a network of health care providers that would meet the needs of our seniors." If other insurers take similar action, the Medicare Advantage program could be seriously undermined, and its 7 million enrollees could be forced out of the program. Those who remain will have to live with fewer benefits. Independent Payment Advisory Board, IPAB. One of the biggest obstacles to reform under our system of government is the lack of political will needed to pass unpopular laws. Afraid to cast controversial votes that could cost them election victories, political leaders often push difficult public policy problems down the road to the next generation of Americans. Healthcare, of course, is a prominent example of buck passing, as Medicare and Medicaid have proven largely impervious to needed budgetary reform since they were created in the 1960s. In order to break through this political logjam, Obamacare will establish a new Independent Payment Advisory Board, IPAB, as a means to reduce healthcare costs in Medicare, a budgetary black hole that sucks in an increasing stream of taxpayer dollars as the American population ages. Although little attention has been paid to the IPAB, it's potentially a powerful cost-cutting mechanism within the new law. Pete Orszag, the former White House budget director, observed that it could be the most important part of Obamacare in bending the cost curve down. The new board won't be a rubber stamp on the wishes of the White House and Congress, as it will operate independent of their control. Former Senator Tom Daschle, one of Obamacare's most important architects, tellingly declared in his 2008 book, Critical, "The federal health board I envision for our country would be modeled on the U.S. Federal Reserve System." Daschle spent 50 pages explaining why he thought an entity like the IPAB was a good idea. Daschle got what he wanted. Unlike typical presidential commissions, which usually have no real power, the IPAB will be able to make recommendations that actually mean something. That's because the board's decisions are automatically binding unless Congress blocks them. And that will be difficult to do since the new law stipulates that it will require a 3/5 supermajority to overturn IPAB decisions. A filibuster, which requires 60 votes in the Senate, cannot be used. Given this significant hurdle, it seems likely that many of the board's decisions will become the law of the land. While an empowered, energetic IPAB will create needed budgetary reforms outside the normal legislative process, depending on the reform, that could be a good thing, critics see it as another heavy-handed power grab used by Obamacare to increase government control over the nation's healthcare system. They argue that the people's elected representatives will be bypassed, and spending cuts in Medicare's budget will be handed down as autocratic decrees from appointed healthcare commissars. Those who support the IPAB point out that its undemocratic traits are hardly unprecedented, since the Federal Reserve has operated since 1913 without direct political control over its decisions. However the IPAB is characterized, no one will be able to say that its decisions lack substance. It will consist of a heavyweight panel of 15 experts, chosen from academia, think tanks, and the healthcare industry. Appointees will be handpicked by the president and must be approved by the Senate before they can take their seat. They'll be asked to make cost-cutting recommendations for Medicare whenever spending per person in the program rises faster than the Consumer Price Index, something which seems likely to occur more often than not. The Republican Party has expressed a desire to eliminate the board before it gets started. Even if the IPAB convenes, Congress could neutralize its power by stripping away its funding. If the Republicans attempt to eliminate the IPAB, they will have powerful allies, as Big Pharma, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturing Association, hospitals, the American Hospital Association, and doctors, the American Medical Association, have all declared their opposition to it. The American people are also likely to take a dim view of the IPAB once they learn more about it, because an influential government body, unaccountable to their wishes, is contrary to our constitutional guarantee of self-government, the example of the Federal Reserve notwithstanding. Assuming the board actually begins to operate, it will be able to make binding recommendations starting in 2015, with none implemented until 2018. Chapter 11, Cost Control Experiments. In decreasing the uninsured population and in guaranteeing a raft of new consumer benefits, Obamacare is far from restrained. But when it comes to bending the cost curve down, it is hesitant and halting, preferring to push politically charged actions into the future by using a commission such as the Independent Payment Advisory Board. This kick-the-can-down-the-road approach is evident in an array of pilot programs that are included in the new law. These programs are, in effect, a series of non-binding experiments to test new ways to deliver, manage, and pay for health care in the United States. That is all well and good, but it doesn't do anything meaningful to deal with the pressing problem of rising costs, which has been exacerbated by new Obamacare rules. The pilot programs contain Obamacare's biggest ideas for the future of health care in the United States. The thinking is that if one of these approaches works on a small scale, it can be expanded to the entire country. In other words, the new law throws a bunch of ideas up against a wall to see if any stick. In this sense, it's reminiscent of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, which also included many experiments in search of a solution to a pressing national problem. Bundled payments in Medicare. In light of the huge amount of money that Medicare spends on hospital and post-hospital treatment, more than $200 billion a year, Obamacare explores new ways to get more value out of taxpayer dollars that are directed at this important area of the healthcare system. It does so by creating a pilot program within Medicare that moves away from the traditional fee-for-service payment model in widespread use today and tests a bundled payment system for inpatient hospital services and post-discharge treatment. Under the new scheme, a single lump-sum payment will be delivered to an organization such as a hospital, which will then hire a team of healthcare professionals to provide care to an individual patient for a specific health-related episode over a set period of time. An episode timeline could, for example, begin 3 days before hospitalization and end 30 days after discharge. The team might include professionals from the hospital, doctors in a physician group, members of a skilled nursing facility, and caregivers in a home health care agency. Bundled payments are one way in which Obamacare tries to reduce the number of hospital stays by Medicare recipients, a significant factor of driving up costs. As it now stands, a hospital will usually wash its hands of a patient after discharge. The goal of the new pilot program is to prevent such costly breaks in what should ideally be a continuous chain of care. It tries to keep all stakeholders connected to one another throughout the patient's health-related episode, regardless of its duration. It also aims to reduce the number of costly hospital readmissions. The pilot program is scheduled to begin in January 2013 and run for approximately 3 years. If it proves successful in reducing hospitalizations, as well as the cost of overall care, without sacrificing quality, Congress will consider expanding the program. Its performance will be assessed by the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, AHRQ, which will use measures such as hospital readmission rates and feedback from patients to make a recommendation to Congress about the program's future viability. Time will tell whether the pilot test of bundled payments for continuous treatment works, but the new approach would seem on its face to create an incentive for the members of the treatment team to cut corners and skimp on care. After all, the more treatment they provide, the more their profit margins shrink, since the amount they are paid is fixed at a specific amount. To help reduce this possibility, members of a treatment team will receive increased financial rewards if they can help patients recover quickly. A bundled payment system would probably work best when there are no surprises in treatment along the way, as with standard, easily defined, and managed procedures such as joint replacements. If the system is eventually rolled out across the United States, its use might be restricted to medical conditions such as these and avoided for less predictable health conditions. Independence at Home Demonstration. With similar goals in mind, Obamacare tests a new demonstration project in Medicare, wherein a team of health professionals delivers care to needy Medicare recipients in their own homes. If the members of the treatment team are able to prevent hospital readmissions, reduce costs, and improve outcomes, all while simultaneously achieving patient satisfaction, they will be given financial rewards. The program is directed primarily at Medicare recipients who suffer from more than one chronic condition, who have the worst medical outcomes, and who cost the most money. It's modeled on similar programs that have proved successful throughout the country. It's also worth mentioning that the Independence at Home demonstration will evaluate e-care technology, including remote monitoring of health conditions such as blood pressure by computers and other electronic devices, to see if it helps reduce cost and improve efficiency of care. The program began in January 2012. The perfect storm of overutilization. If we want to understand the overarching theme of Obamacare's experiments in healthcare cost control, it's spelled out in an essay written by President Obama's healthcare advisor, Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, in the June 2008 issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association. In his essay, titled "The Perfect Storm of Overutilization," Dr. Emanuel asserts that the most important contributor to the high cost of U.S. healthcare is overutilization. Too much money, he says, is spent per person because Americans overuse the healthcare system, visiting doctors and hospitals more than they need to, seeking out expensive specialists in lieu of primary care physicians, and demanding tests and procedures that they don't really need. Higher costs also come because Americans demand amenities, such as expensive hospital rooms they could do without. According to Dr. Emanuel, the way to control healthcare costs is to wring fluffy, self-indulgent excess out of the system. Part of this excess, he says, comes from the current fee-for-service payment system, which creates a big incentive for overutilization. Knowing that they will be paid more if they do more, doctors inevitably order more tests and schedule more patient visits than are needed. Fear of malpractice suits may also motivate doctors to prescribe additional and unnecessary tests and procedures. Dr. Emanuel concludes by saying that costs cannot be controlled unless overutilization is substantially reduced by giving better financial incentives to doctors to deliver less care to their patients. While reducing overutilization may seem like a sensible solution, the economist Thomas Sowell has pointed out that spending less on something isn't the same as lowering its cost. If, for example, Americans are compelled by Obamacare to make less use of expensive medical technologies, they will merely do without those technologies, and the quality of their care will decrease. The price to use the technologies will remain unchanged. The debate over overutilization ultimately boils down to who decides what constitutes excess and what is truly essential to treat a patient. While sensible rules can be put in place to govern these care decisions in a general sense, doctors are obviously better equipped than government bureaucrats to make treatment decisions for individual patients. Hospital readmission reduction. In another pilot program, again aimed at keeping patients out of hospitals where costs typically rocket upward, Obamacare tests a pay-for-performance Medicare payment system for hospitals based on readmission levels. It is estimated that about 20% of all Medicare patients discharged from hospitals must be readmitted within 30 days, in many cases because they were discharged prematurely because their care was mishandled. The pilot program addresses this problem, which costs Medicare billions of dollars in wasted spending each year by penalizing hospitals that are the worst offenders. The Department of Health and Human Services will identify hospitals that have shown weakness in this area and single them out for lower Medicare payments. The goal will be to see if increased accountability for readmissions improves the performance of hospitals in this aspect of care. Isolated hospitals in rural communities or in other areas like inner cities where they are the sole providers of medical services will be excluded from penalties. Accountable care organizations. In another pilot program, Obamacare encourages the use of so-called accountable care organizations, ACOs, which are groups of healthcare professionals that deliver team-based care to patients, similar to that provided in the bundled payments pilot and the Independence at Home demonstration initiatives. ACOs with at least 5,000 Medicare recipients will be able to participate in a demonstration program created by the new law. Each ACO that signs up must accept all patients, even those in the worst health. The program will work this way. Hospitals, physicians, and home care providers will work together to deliver comprehensive and continuous care to each patient that agrees to participate. Each member of the treatment team will be paid by the government on a fee-for-service basis, with bonuses paid out for quality care that is delivered below a given dollar threshold. These have yet to be determined by the Department of Health and Human Services. The idea is to provide an incentive to each member of the treatment team to cooperate and drive down costs. The program began in January 2012 and lasts 3 years. The authors of Obamacare believe that accountable care organizations are the future of healthcare delivery in the United States. If they're right, the cost of care will decrease with the expansion of ACOs throughout the country. Although the ACO pilot program is only a small part of Obamacare, it is central to the new law's underlying long-term objective: abolish the fragmented healthcare system currently in use today and replace it with networks of doctors, specialists, and hospitals working together in efficient, coordinated harmony. Accountable care organizations are, in a general sense, analogous to the health insurance exchanges that will be set up in each state in 2014. The exchanges are designed to be great magnets pulling different types of health insurance under their umbrellas. They will start out as marketplaces for insurance sold to individuals and small businesses, but eventually they could absorb the entire employer-based insurance system that is used today by half of the American population. ACOs are in a much earlier stage of development than the exchanges, but they are also meant to function as great magnets, pulling in healthcare professionals the same way the exchanges pull in individuals and businesses. Both ACOs and the exchanges promise, in short, to centralize healthcare in the United States in order to make it cheaper and better. This isn't quite socialized medicine, but it is a step in that direction. Obamacare's requirement that the nation's Medicare program create an ACO program is well underway. As of mid-2012, 154 individual ACOs had been approved by the White House and are in operation, serving about 2.4 million Medicare patients. They are expected to save as much as $5 billion over the next 8 years. ACOs are also sprouting up in the private sector, with doctor groups, hospitals, and private insurers leading the way instead of the federal government. Blue Shield of California, for instance, has 6 ACOs currently operating in the state. Comparative Effectiveness Research. Obamacare promises to eventually bring down healthcare costs in the United States by leveraging best practices as seen in pilot programs funded by the new law. To achieve the same end, it also promises to make heavy use of so-called comparative effectiveness research, which is a fancy way of saying that the government will study the hard data associated with healthcare delivery to determine where the greatest savings can be made and where the system can be improved most. In this effort, Obamacare will certainly not lack information, as study after study produced by academia, think tanks, foundations, and the like have shown that the current healthcare system generates massive waste and overspending. To supervise its comparative effectiveness research, Obamacare will create a nonprofit patient-centered outcomes research institute. The institute will be managed by a board of governors, and its findings will be used as non-binding recommendations. A more powerful agency like the Independent Payment Advisory Board, however, will be free to act on its findings. What about tort reform? One of the biggest reasons for rising medical costs in the United States is the high prices doctors must pay for medical malpractice insurance. According to an analysis by the journal Health Affairs, a massive amount of money, $56 billion, or 2.4% of all healthcare spending, is spent on medical malpractice insurance each year. No doctor wants to be on the hook for millions of dollars if he or she makes a mistake, causes a patient harm, and loses a lawsuit. As a result, many doctors practice defensive medicine, ordering more tests than they need to and undertaking procedures that are not necessary to reduce their legal jeopardy. The impact of defensive medicine can be clearly seen, for example, in the high number of babies born by cesarean section, many of which result not from medical need, but rather from doctors wanting to protect themselves from a potential lawsuit. Although Obamacare is rooted in the idea that overutilization drives up medical costs, and defensive medicine practices indisputably add fuel to this fire, the new law does almost nothing in the area of tort reform. It does award grants to the states over a 5-year period to study alternatives to medical litigations, but this is lip service given to the issue, not real action. According to President Obama's first budget director, Pete Orszag, the new law missed an important opportunity to shield from malpractice liability any doctors who followed evidence-based guidelines in treating their patients. In supporting tort reform, Orszag went off the reservation and joined many critics of Obamacare. But his argument was different from theirs. The critics usually support capping the amount of damages that can be awarded in medical malpractice lawsuits. Orszag, in contrast, supports the idea of creating safe harbors for doctors who follow approved practices and standards